Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a Damn Interesting Week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
All right. From the Smithsonian. You know I love a good dig story. And dig this.
dig. Okay.
Yes. I went there. An Austrian man discovered hundreds of mammoth bones while renovating his wine cellar. Like you do.
Huh. I mean, if I had a wine cellar, I guess I'd probably want to renovate it sometimes.
You know, and you dig deep and you go to some really cool ancient areas. But for this particular man, Andreas Pernenstorfer, he was renovating his wine cellar in northern Austria when he stumbled on something unusual. Now, at first, he thought it was a piece of wood, maybe left behind by his grandfather, an old tool, something like that. But then he remembered something his grandfather had mentioned once about finding teeth in the cellar when renovating it decades ago.
Oh, I thought it was going to be like that time I murdered a mammoth and buried it in the cellar.
Well, you know, with just information like I once found teeth in the cellar,
right?
That could be, but yeah. It actually, because of that little seed that had been planted, this man thought, you know, maybe this piece of wood was actually something more special. So he reported the discovery, and it turns out those instincts were right. His wine cellar was full of huge mammoth bones, at least 300 of them. Now, since the middle of May, researchers with the Austrian Archaeological Institute at the Academy of Sciences, they've been excavating the site, which is located in Gobelsberg, which is a small town about 45 minutes northwest of Vienna. And so far, they have found bones that belong to three individual mammoths, plus charcoal and stone artifacts. They're thinking that the bones, which were stacked on top of one another, are between 30 and 40,000 years old. Archaeologists have only excavated a 129 square foot site. So this is some dense mammoth bone distribution, if you think about it. And they're not even really sure how or why they had three mammoths stacked up on each other in the same spot.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like they were hunted, not they all just happened to die right in the same spot. Like with the signs of civilization around it, it seems like probably this was like their cooking pit or something.
Well, that is one possibility. They do have strong indications that humans hunted for them. We've just never really known how. But we know that elephants have issues with slopes. So maybe they were hunted on a slope and therefore vulnerable, which is the most delicate way to bring that to life.
I mean, the slope theory is good. I feel like Elmer Fudd has taught me that they also might have dressed up as a sexy mammoth to like lure them over.
I'm sure we will find ancient artifacts of an anvil.
Right.
Next link.
This article comes to us from The Conversation. Sleeping on it really does help, and four other recent sleep research breakthroughs. So, 26 years, that's roughly how much of our lives are spent asleep. Scientists have been trying to explain why we spend so much time sleeping since at least the ancient Greeks, but pinning down the exact functions of sleep has proven to be difficult. So, here's some of the biggest recent breakthroughs in that science of sleep. We know more about lucid dreaming now, so U.S. researchers in a 2017 study woke their participants up at regular intervals during the night and asked them what was going through their minds prior to the alarm call, which is just kind of rude. I mean, I get that's why they're doing the study, but can you imagine, like, if somebody you knew just, like, woke you up and was like, hey, what were you dreaming? Like, So sometimes the participants couldn't recall any dreaming. The study team then looked at what was happening in the participants' brain moments before waking. Participants' recall of dream content was associated with increased activity in the posterior hot zone, an area of the brain closely linked to conscious awareness. Researchers could predict the presence or absence of dream experiences by monitoring this zone in real time. Another exciting development in the study of dreams is research into lucid dreams in which you're aware that you're dreaming. A 2021 study established two-way communication between a dreamer and a researcher.
What?
Yeah, it's not like the researcher was not also in a lucid dream, unfortunately. Okay. It's not cool like that. So a 2021 study established that two-way communication where the participants signaled to the researcher that they were dreaming by moving their eyes in a pre-agreed pattern. The researcher read out maths problems, what is 8 minus 6, and the dreamer could respond to this question with eye movements, which, why do you have to, like, make them do math? Like, use something simpler. But the dreamers were accurate, indicating they had access to high-level cognitive functions. Mm. The researchers used polysomnography, which monitors bodily functions such as breathing and brain activity during sleep, to confirm that they were actually asleep and not just closing their eyes and doing math. These discoveries have dream researchers excited about the future of interactive dreaming, such as practicing a skill or solving a problem in our dreams. So the next thing we know is that our brain replays memories while we sleep. A 2021 study found that training algorithms to distinguish between different memories while awake makes it possible to see the same neural patterns re-emerge in the sleeping brain. A different study, also in 2021, found that the more times these patterns re-emerge during sleep, the bigger the benefit to memory. In other approaches, scientists have been able to reactivate certain memories by replaying sounds associated with the memory in question while the participant was asleep.
Hmm.
Third, sleep keeps our minds healthy. You've probably heard that one before, but laboratory sleep deprivation studies where researchers keep willing participants awake throughout the night have been combined with functional MRI brain scans to paint a detailed picture of the sleep-deprived brain. These studies have shown that a lack of sleep severely disrupts the connectivity between different brain networks. These changes include a breakdown of connectivity between brain regions responsible for cognitive control and an amplification of those involved in threat and emotional processing.
Hmm.
Sleep loss may even make you less likely to help other people. And by the way, for like every other sentence in this article, there is a link to a full study and more articles. So if you're interested in any of this, definitely check this one out. And finally, sleep actually protects us against diseases. The buildup of B amyloid is one of the mechanisms underlying Alzheimer's disease. Sleep deprivation increases the rate of buildup of B amyloid in parts of the brain involved in memory, such as the hippocampus. But the good news is that research is developing treatments to get a better night's sleep and boost its benefits. For example, the European Sleep Research Society and the American Academy of Sleep Medicine recommend cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia, or CBTI, which works by identifying thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that contribute to insomnia, which can then be modified to help promote sleep. These interventions can improve other aspects of our lives as well. A 2021 meta-analysis of 65 clinical trials found that improving sleep via CBTI reduced symptoms of depression, anxiety, rumination, and stress.
Yeah, I wonder, too, how much Benadryl and why am I brain farting on the drug that everybody takes to go to sleep?
Oh, Ambien.
Ambien, thank you. Yeah, I'm curious to see if they would do a study to see how much that disrupts those processes you're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Right, like you're sleeping, but you're not.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Because I have been a habitual Benadryl user for, I don't know, 20 years now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, sometimes the sleep's not so good.
Right, it's the Diet Coke of sleep.
Right. Yeah. I will throw out there some bro science stuff that I'm aware of. You know, take this with a grain of salt, but I have seen people report that doing certain types of breathing techniques, which essentially boil down to meditation, but like Buteyko breathing, actually reduces the amount of sleep. And the theory is that sleep is really about oxygen intake. And I can actually attest to this in my personal life, where there have been times where I was meditating for a lot, like 1 to 2 hours a day. And when I was meditating for that much, I only needed like 5 hours of sleep and I woke up completely refreshed. So I'm curious to see if there's anything we find out about the science of that. But it'll probably take some time for those fields to cross over.
Or just, you know, we forget that our brains are still meat, right? And so if we treat our brains like meat and have sort of like a cool down actual transition into sleep, it does signal things in ways that we may not be consciously aware of.
Yeah, but that takes a lot of work. Mm-hmm. I'd rather just take a pill.
A lot of work.
Well, and I mean, it basically, to study it, we're going to need some scientists. You're going to have to meditate, and then the scientists are going to shake you awake and be like, how you feeling? Are you feeling good?
How you feeling now?
Come on. They've been doing this to monks forever. I don't know about the shake awake stuff, but they've definitely been putting EKG monitors on them for a while.
Right, right.
More research.
Agreed. Next link.
Next link.
Well, speaking of meat brains, this is a really cool or horrifying story, or both, from New Atlas. Living brain cell biocomputers are now training on dopamine.
Oh.
Yay, we're there now. So here's the justification, other than just being crazy scientists. Current AI training methods burn a colossal amount of energy to learn. But the human brain just takes a paltry 20 watts. So Swiss startup Final Spark is now selling access to cyborg biocomputers running up to 4 living human brain organoids wired into silicon chips.
Oh boy.
Yep. Since the brain communicates with the rest of the body through electrical signals, this makes brain tissue highly compatible with silicon chips, as long as you can keep it alive. There are pictures of the little meatballs included in the article. They do. They look like tiny little meatballs.
They prefer brain balls. Thank you very much.
They're about 0.5 millimeters in diameter. They're kept in incubators at around body temperature, supplied with water and nutrients, and protected from bacterial or viral contamination while wired into an electrical circuit with a series of tiny electrodes. I feel like there's more to it, but because neurons habitually search for patterns seeking order and predictability, so they can be rewarded with predictable stimuli and, say, quote, punished with chaotic stimuli.
Oh, no.
I know.
No,
and they will quickly rewire themselves to become adept at orienting themselves towards those rewards, as we do with our brain.
We're abusing the meatballs is what's happening.
What if we didn't have a trauma-based framework for
growth?
Well, that's
a little
evolution.
Bit what this one's getting at. So, okay, this is not the first time scientists have attempted this. Notably, the Australian Dish Brain device by Cortical Labs, which uses 800,000 human brain cells grown onto silicon chips. Dish Brain managed to learn to play Pong within about 5 minutes.
Wow.
And has demonstrated impressive capabilities as a super efficient machine learning tool. And guess who they've gotten funding by? Military, of course.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that makes sense.
The Final Spark team uses smaller organoids wired into arrays, but it adds the ability to flood the organoids with reward hormones like dopamine when they've done a good job. Who's a good little organoid? So, to your point, a little bit more of the positive reinforcement for this one. According to co-founder Dr. Fred Jordan, when we want to reward the organoid, we expose it to specific light frequencies. This light opens up the cage, releasing the dopamine and providing the intended stimulus to the organoid. Huh. So here are the two big questions. Are these things sentient? Well, no one knows. There's no. I wish they would have said no, but no, we're in the no.
Well,
no one
we
knows.
We can't even admit that plants are sentient. We're still waffling on that one. So
right. And then the second big question, is it ethical? And that's a deep rabbit hole that they're not even going to go down in the article. So the answer is, no.
Well, I'm sure they found that those qualified enough to weigh in on that are vanishingly few.
But despite all of that, they could be very useful, both as ultra-efficient cyborg machine learning platforms and also as a remarkable new tool to test the effects of various drugs into the brain's information processing capabilities.
Well, I mean, if we don't have to do this on puppies anymore, that'd be kind of nice, right?
Yeah. No, you know what? You're right. Honestly, people should start taking one for the team. No more animal testing. Right.
And if it's from stem cells, right, it's everybody could be a donor. What could possibly go wrong with that?
And here's the idea. The idea is to scale up as AI, right? Because when AI scales up, this thirst for electricity will become insatiable. Mm-hmm. So hopefully with this tech, we can make it more efficient.
I mean, yeah, it's our AI overlords will enslave us all. That's what's going
to
happen.
Way to roll over and already just like go with a future instead of trying to prevent that from happening. Good job, guys.
Well, you know, again, Star Trek used Neurogel ethically. I mean, sure, it's a TV show, but...
We think they could have all been jerks. You just listen. The history is written by the victors. Star Trek was telling us what they wanted us to hear.
That's right.
They could have had horrible, horrible experiments going on behind
course.
The scenes.
They never told us how they fixed capitalism.
True. All right. Next link.
Next link.
All right. Next up, we have an article from The Guardian called Scientists Develop Method of Making Healthier, More Sustainable Chocolate.
Oh, yes.
Now, I'll be honest. What I'm thinking is it can't possibly taste good. And that may be the case. I haven't eaten any of it. But the team who made this new product are Swiss, which maybe lends them some credibility in the chocolate department. So the key here is that they have replaced the sugar in confectionery chocolate with a sweet, fibrous gel made from the pulp and husk of the cocoa pod. Now, in normal chocolate production, we just use the beans and throw away the rest. But according to Kim Mishra, a food technologist at ETH Zurich and lead author of the study, quote, "The cocoa fruit is basically a pumpkin, and right now we're just using the seeds, but there's a lot of other marvelous stuff in that fruit." So perhaps one of the reasons no one ever thought to try this before is because the new ingredient is a gel, and introducing moisture into the chocolate-making process is usually a no-go. So they had to add an extra drying step, which was concerning at first because while the new process used 6% less land and water than sugar, planet warming emissions were estimated to be about 12% higher due to the energy of that drying process. And higher emissions is especially bad when we're talking about chocolate, because it turns out chocolate is one of the most environmentally damaging foods out there.
Oh.
In terms of greenhouse gases per kilogram of food, it ranks all the way up alongside some meats. So, any major revolution in chocolate production is realistically going to have to reduce, not increase, the environmental impact. But the team kept pushing and discovered that their initial estimates were wrong once the new process was scaled up, because in larger quantities, they were able to use a combination of drying in the sun and a little extra energy from solar panels, and the end result brought emissions down below what is currently used by the industry. So that's two boxes checked, right? It's definitely more sustainable and definitely healthier, because just about anything is healthier than raw sugar. But there is another problem, besides taste, that might prevent this plan from coming to fruition. And that has to do with the current production pipeline for chocolate.
The great sugar lobby.
Right. Well, that's honestly kind of it. It's just sort of reframed as a geopolitical thing.
I got it.
Yeah. It's not us. It's everything.
Right. Right. Well, because right now the beans are harvested mostly in South America, but they are processed elsewhere in the world for the addition of the sugar. But because this new version of chocolate uses waste products from the bean collecting process, the sweet fibrous gel would need to be created and added to the chocolate in those same South American countries. So it would basically shift the entire infrastructure and the attendant profits to those countries. And, you know, realistically, that's a benefit that's long overdue, because the workers in these countries currently only receive a tiny fraction of the $100 billion chocolate industry.
I mean, that's capitalism in a nutshell.
Yeah. And it is fair to say that we can expect to see some pushback from the people who are currently making those profits. As for the taste, even Mishra admits that there is a limit to how sweet the fibrous gel can get. Currently, they're able to make a product that is supposedly indistinguishable from good dark chocolate. But even with the drying process, you can't add too much of the gel or you run into those moisture problems. But he also thinks there's actually room for consumers to even prefer the flavor of the new dark chocolate, which has, quote, more fruity notes and acidity, which does make it seem like it's not actually indistinguishable from traditional dark chocolate like they're claiming. But maybe he only means once you start adding more and more of the fibrous gel to get it more sweet, as, you know, Americans are used to.
Well, Americans in particular, our palate has already been conditioned to inferior chocolate. Like, it is known and has been documented that we have more sour kind of chocolate that doesn't have the same mouthfeel due to the other ingredients that we are not forbidden to use. So it still may be a step up from what we're used to, just depending on how low that bar is.
Yeah, but also, like, what if we've grown to prefer that? What if we're like, I like eating chemicals. They taste so good to me.
100%.
That's the
I
American
like eating
way.
Chemicals. They taste very good to me.
Yeah. But, you know, you get this in other countries at least, and then it becomes the exotic chocolate, and then maybe you start to get some cachet around it. Or not. Maybe we all die of diabetes before that happens. Who can say?
Whoa!
Next link.
All right. We're going to put a stop to that and a stop to time with the BBC and look at the woman who sold time and the man who tried to stop her. Yes, it sounds like a Doctor Who episode. I know.
Yeah.
But specifically, we're looking at the Belleville family, who for over a century had one member of the family who would visit the Royal Observatory at Greenwich at least 3 times a week. He or she would then set the time on a watch and then head across London to sell that information to their clients.
Wow.
Huh.
Right? Because synchronized time, how was it done at first?
Right.
Kind of like that for a really long time. And when the last of the Belleville time sellers, as they were known, Ruth, died in 1943, she had clocked up more than half a century collecting the time and passing it on. Now, at one point, a competitor, one St. John Wynne, had tried to scupper the company, but it was kind of an early Streisand effect situation. It backfired spectacularly, and in the end, he just boosted Belleville's business. So what he was trying to do, he was trying to poach customers for, of course, his own time synchronization company. And he made a speech that was later published in the Times, and he was claiming that the Belleville method was, quote, amusingly out of date. And hey, it's kind of hard not to agree with that, given where we are in history, right? But he fought dirty, because of course he did. He also intimated that Ruth Belleville was using her feminine wiles to get custom. The best part is there are some old-timey photographs in here, and that's a stretch, friend. Listen, I'm just being real because that's such a low blow. It was, you know, it was just someone in the family. It was a family tradition. It was started by John Henry Belleville all the way back in 1836. He was the child of a refugee who fled the French Revolution and then became a ward and apprentice of the Astronomer Royal at the time, one John Pond. And businesses in the early 19th century that wanted an accurate time, maybe clockmakers, horologists, even the banks and city firms needed this, what they would do is they would send an employee to the Royal Observatory to bang on the door and say, "Hey, let me see your clock." Now, Pond's successor, the person who became the Royal Astronomer, was like, "Nope, we're not doing this anymore." And he limited the access to once a week. So this gave Belleville the chance to start his time distribution company. Because he was the former assistant to the now retired Royal Astronomer, he had the access already, and he visited Greenwich Observatory every morning. So what he would do is set his pocket watch first thing, and then he'd go off in his buggy to clients who would then pay a fee to look at his clock and set their own timepieces. It's kind of simple but beautiful. And as the first person to institute this business model, when he died in 1856, he had over 200 subscribers. His then third wife and only widow, Maria, took on the job. Then when Maria died, their daughter, Elizabeth Ruth, became the time seller. And they all used the same watch.
Wow.
It was imbued with such importance, it kind of became a talisman of its own, right?
Yeah.
It was a John Arnold watch. It was originally made for the Duke of Sussex, who rejected it because he said it, quote, looked like a bedpan.
Oh.
And ran slow.
Right. Well, sometimes it did, but, you know, it was such a staggeringly simple idea, and it was so simple that more technological pioneers underestimated how genius this was. So when this guy who tried to disrupt the business, he addressed a group of London city councillors and aldermen to point out that the irregularities of London's public clocks are directly responsible for an immense amount of financial loss. Oh, right in the pocketbook. He would go on to describe the inconvenience of the Belleville system and blamed the, quote, present vagaries on a woman possessed of a chronometer. The business is carried on this day by her successor. Still a female, I think.
she hasn't changed. She's still a female.
Yeah. And the picture that they then intersperse in the article directly underneath is like a 60, 70-year-old woman with a hat, not even smiling. Mm-hmm.
She's so hot and sexy. The astronomer had no choice but to let her in. And
yeah. And this rant went on. He would go on to insult almost everybody. So he would just rip on her. And then he was like, "Oh, I'm going to compare London unfavorably to Paris, Berlin, and other continental cities." Then he would move on to the private clock owners themselves for, quote, failing to recognize their responsibilities and bemoaning the public's attitude to time in general. And this is all because he was keen to promote the Standard Time Company, a commercial enterprise that supplied hourly electric time pulses to automatically corrected clocks.
To be fair, that's a better system.
Sure. But you don't get customers by insulting them.
No. Nope.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't, but I have feminine wiles to help me, so.
Right. And you're not wrong. It is not unusual within 100 yards, as a Mr. John Cockburn from Upper Norwood suggested, to find clocks 3 or 4 minutes at variance with each other. Highly desirable as individualism is, in many respects, it is out of place in horology, right? But all of these people who were, I guess, effectively hashtagging and dumping on threads in ye olde times, they didn't realize the Streisand effect that they were putting into action. Because instead of spurring people to abandon this old-fashioned Belleville method and get with the times, the correspondence brought her services to the attention of many who had not previously subscribed, because now it became fashionable to have a personal service. Mm. So the media attentions earned Belleville the nickname of the Greenwich Time Lady, and she featured in publications including Tatler, The Evening News. She referred to the watch as Arnold, and she maintained a steady business until 1940. That was when World War II made it difficult for her to walk the street safely at age 86. She died 3 years later with Arnold at her side. If you want to see Arnold, it has been bequeathed to the Clockmakers Company Museum.
I do miss the era, though, when we could show up 10 minutes late and go, my clock says I'm on time.
Yeah, it's not my fault. The Greenwich lady didn't tell me right. So
we had popcorn. Remember, you would call popcorn as a phone number and it would give you the correct time. It would just pulse it out on regular 2 minute intervals.
Time or something.
Yeah, I'm showing my age here. Next link.
Next link.
So this will be a short one. Article comes from BBC.com. It's titled, North Korea Drops Trash Balloons on the South.
Oh, come on. Trash balloons?
Listen, I can't help but appreciate it. It's so petty.
The back and forth, too, yes.
It is incredibly petty. So North Korea has dropped at least 260 balloons carrying rubbish in the South, prompting authorities to warn its residents to stay indoors. Ugh. The balloons have been found in 8 of 9 provinces in South Korea and are now being analyzed. North and South Korea have both used balloons in their propaganda campaigns since the Korean War in the 1950s. The recent incident comes days after North Korea said it would retaliate against the frequent scattering of leaflets and other rubbish in border areas by activists in the South. North Korea's Vice Minister of Defense Kim Kang-il said in a statement to state media on Sunday, "Mounds of waste paper and filth will soon be scattered over the border areas and the interior of the ROK and will directly experience how much effort is required to remove them."
Now you're going to see how hard it is.
Yeah. It's kind of incredible just how completely straight up they are about it. Like, no, we're going to dump trash now and you'll see. Like, wow. So Republic of Korea or ROK is the official name of South Korea, while the North is called DPRK or the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Late on Tuesday, residents living north of the South's capital, Seoul, and in the border region received text messages from their provincial authorities asking them to refrain from outdoor activities. They were also asked to file a report at the nearest military base or police station if they spot an unidentified object. Photographs shared on social media show bags attached via string to white translucent balloons carrying toilet paper, dark soil, and batteries, among other contents. South Korea's military condemned the act as a clear violation of international law, and I guess you could literally call this a bioweapon of some kind.
Right.
In addition to anti-Pyongyang propaganda, activists in South Korea have launched balloons carrying, among other things, cash, banned media content, and even choco pies, a South Korean snack banned in the North.
Yeah, that banned media is a lot of K-pop, apparently.
Yeah. Seoul's parliament passed a law in December 2020 that criminalizes the launch of anti-Pyongyang leaflets, but critics have raised concerns related to freedom of speech and human rights.
I mean, it's better than shooting each other.
Yes.
You know, like if this is what it takes to sort of get the rage out and keep them from bursting out into full-blown war. But also, like, how telling is it that one side is like, we're sending bags of poop, and the other's like, have some K-pop. Like, it's...
But, you know, who's actually receiving and processing and enjoying the K-pop once it lands?
Well, it's illegal to have it, so I imagine they're hiding it.
Yep.
Yeah. I saw a video, I don't remember, I didn't see when it happened, but it was of a K-pop performance actually put on for a North Korean audience. And they're all just stony-faced. Like, they are not enjoying it, but I also kind of assume that they're not allowed to, like, perhaps legally.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. It's the, like, screaming inside, like...
Probably a little bit of both. That's assuming that brainwashing doesn't work. And we know in this country, it works.
Yep. That's true. Maybe they genuinely aren't enjoying it because they've been trained.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
Next link?
Next link.
All right, well, I've got a quick little one here from Science Alert called Strange Metal from Beyond Our Planet Found in Ancient Treasure Stash.
Ooh.
Spoiler alert, it's not alien tech. I know. It's just metal from a meteorite that fell to Earth. But it is a significant finding because it changes our understanding of when and how metalworking operated in ancient times.
Yeah.
So the treasure of Vienna, which is V-I-L-L-E-N-A, it's not in Austria, it's a cache of 66 mostly golden objects. It was discovered in 1963 on the Iberian Peninsula in what is now the town of Alicante in Spain. The metals were initially dated between 1500 and 1200 BCE and have been considered a really important benchmark as far as when goldsmithing began in the area. But there were two objects in the collection that didn't make sense. One was a small hollow hemisphere thought to be part of a scepter or maybe a sword hilt, and the other was a single torque-like bracelet. Both of these objects contained not just gold, but iron. And that was a problem because while goldsmithing did begin in the Bronze Age, iron smelting didn't happen until, logically, the Iron Age, which was at least 400 years later than the estimated age of the treasure. There are, however, a few known cases in archaeology of pre-Iron Age iron being discovered and utilized from meteorites. Because while it's really hard to pull iron out of the ground until you've developed full-on mining technology, these ancient civilizations were perfectly capable of using this pure chunk of iron that fell out of the sky and landed in their backyard. Not surprisingly, these cases are very rare and are generally found in the hands of especially important people. King Tutankhamun, for example, had a dagger made of meteoric iron. And the way you can tell the difference between regular underground iron and meteoric iron is that the latter contains a much higher percentage of nickel.
Hmm.
So the researchers got permission from the Municipal Archaeological Museum of Vienna to test the two outliers from the collection and confirmed that the nickel content of the pieces was, in fact, much higher than expected. The results aren't entirely conclusive because the pieces are corroded, which can change the molecular ratios, but given the age of the rest of the treasure and the amount of gold in it, they feel pretty strongly that the pieces fit a clear narrative of meteoric iron in a highly respected person's collection.
Hmm.
And if that's the case, it would make them the first known cases of meteoric iron on the Iberian Peninsula, which is relatively far away from King Tut in Egypt and indicates that maybe the economic distribution of the era was a little different than previously thought. Basically, they had rich people in Spain, too, is what they're saying.
Nuh-uh.
All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include why AI search blew up in Google's face, Lord Kelvin's tide predicting machine, and the biggest Ponzi scheme in Hollywood history. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at Patreon.com/DamnInteristingWeek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.